This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Ynez Valley. Come along and join us as we visit with Santa Barbara historian Betsy Green. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for meeting with me.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
I follow you on Facebook, and every week you're posting something really cool about Santa Barbara history.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that all happen? How did you get interested in that?
Well, I've only been in Santa Barbara about 11 years. Before that, I was living in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. I really didn't have any interest in history until I moved into an older home. And I got curious about the age of the home, who had lived there. And so I started doing research on the history of the home. I ended up finding out it was built in 1908 by a Swedish-American carpenter. I found a picture of him in the local historical museum, and then I started researching the families who had lived in the home, and in the files of the second family who owned the home, I found a picture of the home from 1913, and that's the kind of thing that old homeowners would kill for. And so once my house was done, I started researching other people's houses. And in the Chicago area, I had a business doing it. I researched about 80 homes. I wrote a book for people who wanted to do it themselves called Discovering the History of Your House and Your Neighborhood. Then about 11 years ago, I moved out to the Santa Barbara area.
And what caused that shift in your life?
Oh, I moved here for three main reasons: December, January, and February.
Yeah.
And then when I got to Santa Barbara, I wasn't sure what I would write about since I'm kind of the new kid on the block here. But I found a couple of niches that nobody else was covering. I live in a neighborhood called the Mesa, which is an interesting neighborhood. It's sort of a bit of a tableland, hence the name. And it was always called the Mesa, whereas other parts of Santa Barbara, other neighborhoods, didn't have their particular name until maybe, you know, the 1915. So I was able to go back through the newspapers back to the 1850s and look for things about the Mesa, or La Mesa, as it used to be called. So I wrote a column about Mesa history for a number of years and wrote a book called Mesapedia about the history of the Mesa. And then I started getting interested in history in Santa Barbara 100 years ago. I always thought that would be the easiest thing to write about because you're just working with 1 year's worth of material. So back in 2014, I looked at the newspapers for Santa Barbara for 1914. We had two newspapers back then. Luckily, the newspapers published more than the usual stuff. A lot of small papers talk about what the mayor did, you know, who got married, who died, and, gee, I think we're going to have a good crop of beans or walnuts this year. But fortunately, in Santa Barbara, there were writers in the papers who were writing about other things. Some of my favorites, and one of the things they did write about, was the Flying A film studio there.
And that predates Hollywood, doesn't it?
In some ways it does, yes. We were one of the biggies back then at that time. Flying A moved to Santa Barbara in 1912, and they had all kinds of adventures as well. Back then, the attitude toward movies was no permits, no problem. They just show up at a bank and have a guy in a mask and a fake gun, and he'd go into the bank, and the tellers would freak out until they saw a guy in the background grinding away at the camera.
Wow.
Another time they were out on a ranch being cowboys, and a lot of the early silent movies were cowboy movies, and they were, you know, shooting back and forth and running around, and some Chinese gardeners who were out there were terrified because they didn't know what the heck was happening. And
were there any Flying A movies that were like nationwide hits?
Back about 1915, the Flying A did have a serial called The Diamond from the Sky, which was one of the early serials. And as you can imagine, we're filming all over the place. And because they were in Santa Barbara, that was also an added incentive for people to go and see the movies. 100 years ago or so, people didn't travel around as much. And so it was really cool to see something filmed in, ooh, Santa Barbara, or ooh, Montecito.
Another dynamic from that time period that you have been reporting on in the last few weeks has to do with the great flu epidemic.
Yes. As I said, I wrote a book about Santa Barbara every year at a time, so I did way back when Santa Barbara in 1918, and then another one in 1919. And at the time, I had no idea that I would be living through something like that. So I certainly am comparing my experiences today to what the people were going through back then. we have a lot more medical knowledge now. The average person back in 1918, 19 really didn't know about viruses. Scientists did, but people knew about germs, but that was it.
But somehow they understood the importance of the mask.
Yes, everybody was wearing a mask. In fact, because they thought it was germs, some sources said, well, put a couple of drops of kerosene or bichloride of mercury on your mask to kill the germs. Of course, it wasn't good for people to breathe. And everybody at home, I am not recommending this. But they did know that it came from other people. It was nicknamed the crowd disease. They knew it was coming, and then about October, it hit in Santa Barbara, October 1918. You think about it, and we get upset about having to wear a mask now, but back then, the war was still going on, and people were still getting telegrams saying, you know, we regret to inform you that your son was killed, blah, blah, blah. So what a horrible, horrible time. And not only that, everything was closed, like today, the libraries, theaters, the pool halls, things like that. So it must have been pretty boring. But the one bright spot was the local record store, and they had phonograph records back then. The local record store sold records on approval. They would deliver a record in the evening. You could listen to it overnight and ask that they pick it up again the next morning.
Wow.
So people had something different to listen to for the night.
And were there deaths in Santa Barbara?
Yes, there were. It's interesting. It's kind of hard to figure out how many there were, because sometimes the newspapers would just say pneumonia, and so you weren't sure what that was. We were also still under wartime censorship, and all the papers were trying to keep up our spirits and downplay bad news, and certainly people dying of the flu were bad news. The flu hit people very quickly. It's different from the COVID deal that we're dealing with now. I remember a story where someone died on Tuesday, and the paper said, and he was fine on Friday night. It also attacked people in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. They were hit the hardest. It seems to be that the flu at that time, the so-called Spanish flu, had been a similar disease, had been around in the 1880s. So if you had been around at that time and you were still around, you had some immunity to it. So it wasn't a disease that older people tended to die of.
Interesting. Yeah, I heard stories of a guy coming home from work on a Wednesday and dead on a Thursday.
It was very sad.
And then it was you or a California history site that was talking about there was a contingent of anti-mask people out there.
We didn't see that in the papers in Santa Barbara. Again, as I said, they were probably focusing on the good news. It was required that if you were going to go on a streetcar, you had to wear a mask. There was one headline that said, "Wear your mask or cops will get you."
So let's move on to a brighter subject.
Well, actually, one thing I might want to point out is you asked about deaths. It seemed to be that, like the war, the flu was also downplayed. One of the things going on at that time was eugenics. There was almost a feeling of if you got the flu or you died from it, either you were not living healthily or you were just sort of bad stock.
Inferior breed.
Right. For the first time at this time in the 19-teens, Santa Barbara school kids were getting weighed and measured, and that was totally new. There were also articles in the paper about the Better Babies campaign.
What was that? That's fascinating. You just wrote about that, didn't you?
Yes. I think it all has to go back with the eugenics, and I think it may also have been the fact that some young men who were drafted were rejected for poor health or something like that.
So moving on, another favorite Betsy subject in Santa Barbara history.
There's a lot of stories, as I mentioned, about sort of human interest stuff, and a number of them were about animals. One of them was, and this was connected with the Flying A, one of the actors had a dog that sometimes appeared in the Flying A movies. And so they were filming a scene out in a rowboat in a lake, and the dog was out there, and as was the actor. And as part of the action, the dog's owner, the actor, was thrown into the lake. Well, the dog, you know, had trouble distinguishing between art and real life, and the dog jumped in to save the owner, even though he wasn't supposed to, and there ruined the take. So the owner got his clothes wet, and they had to redo the take.
Okay.
So that was one.
Mm-hmm.
Another animal movie incident was somebody's monkey. Someone had a pet monkey. It got loose one day, and I guess people did not know about it, and so the monkey went running down the street, and people totally freaked out. Maybe they thought it had rabies or something, but they were calling the cops, they were calling their kids inside and shutting the doors. The cops ran out to catch this animal, and they caught it with a bag of peanuts, And they took him back to the police station, and the monkey was fine with that. And they were playing with the monkey at the police station until the owner showed up.
What year was this?
This was about 1914, 15.
Uh-huh. So and front page news then.
Oh, yes, yes. And the owner showed up, and it turned out the monkey had appeared in one of the Flying A movies. And the owner mentioned that the monkey's name was Caruso. So fortunately, I was able to find old movie magazines online. And this is a great time to be a historian. So I went back to the movie magazines, and I found a picture of the monkey Caruso, who had been in the movies. Another animal story in the movies was in one movie, an actress had to pet a frog. Well, my goodness, they acted like she was, you know, being asked to perform naked with an alligator or something. It was big brouhaha. So there were like four stories in the paper about this. First, they caught it. So it's, oh my goodness, we got it. Next story, is it a frog or is it a toad? Apparently nobody knew. Next story, well, should we feed it flies or crackers? Next story, oh, it died. Well, not surprisingly. Then they needed to find another one. Oh, this is newspaper material.
I love it. We need more of that, frogs and
well, yes, yeah. I'm sure it was a great thing to read. And then last one of the movie stars here had a dog, and she named her dog Guess. So this was, she thought, a real hoo-ha-ha. People would say, what's your dog's name? And she would say Guess. And they'd go round and around and around.
Montecito, for more than 100 years, has been a second escape place. People like you that relocated from the East Coast and Midwest because of the weather. Some top executives. I remember the CEO of Aero Shirts moved out here. Yeah.
Well, yes, and it's funny. As I moved out here, I thought, well, everything I knew about Chicago, I'll have to forget about. But if you were a wealthy business owner in Chicago and you could afford it, you came out here for the winter. There's rumors about Charlie Chaplin. He never filmed out here, as far as I could figure out in all my research. He did visit here. He was a part owner of one of the hotels.
Oh, yeah, the Montecito Inn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they make a big thing about him, but there have been a number of stories saying, no, no.
Okay, well, moving on, give us another cool subject.
Speaking of Montecito, as I started doing research for the Way Back When books, I started noticing that a number of movie studios were filming on the big estates in Montecito. Because you think about it, if you've seen them, some of them look like ancient Rome or France in the time of Louis XIV or whatever. And apparently the owners of the estates were very amenable to movie companies filming on their property.
So this was beyond Flying A. These were Hollywood-based studios that would come up here to do filming here.
Well, some of them were from Hollywood. Some of them were local. I found for my Montecito movie book about 63 movies filmed in Montecito. Mm-hmm. About 20 or so were filmed by the Flying A. But a 40 or so came up from Hollywood or the L.A. area, to film on the estates there. And some of the estates are so big, you can see by looking at the movies that they came up one year to the same estate and filmed in one part of the garden, and the next year they came up and they filmed in another part of the garden, and the movie viewers would have no idea they were reusing the same estate, but they had checked it out while they were here. And there were movies filmed in Montecito even before the Flying A got to town.
Oh, wow. So
the
real early.
Really, yes. Yeah. The Flying A came to Santa Barbara in 1912. But in doing my research for Montecito, I discovered movies that were filmed in Montecito as early as 1910 and 1911. So I went through the old movie magazines and local papers looking for information and photos. It's a lot of tedious research, but one of the things that I do to make it interesting is go through the summaries of the movies and then write about them kind of the way I would describe them to a friend of mine. Well, another thing that I'm writing about in terms of movies is movies filmed on the Channel Islands. Mm-hmm. There are 8 Channel Islands, and initially I thought there were only about 50 movies filmed out there. But once I started doing some serious research in the old movie magazines, I've discovered more than about 250.
Tell us about the Buffalo.
Oh, the Buffalo were there on Santa Catalina Island for an early Western movie. And for some reason, people thought it was cool, and they just left them there. Or else they left and never said why they were leaving the buffalo there, the bison.
But they're still there today,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are.
And when was that movie filmed?
I believe it was in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Most of the movies that I found, the 260 or so movies, the bulk of them were on Santa Catalina, in part because it was near Hollywood, and in part because it was a large island. There was varied terrain, and you could go out, and it was not very developed compared to the Hollywood area, so you could go out and film a pirate movie and not worry about utility lines in the background or something like that.
Right. And why did Flying A go away? Why did Santa Barbara as a film locale dissipate?
Good question. Whatever happened to Flying A? Well, they were there in Santa Barbara until about 1920-21, making a lot of movies, but one of the problems was they were isolated from Hollywood. When they were starting, Hollywood wasn't much bigger, but eventually Hollywood, LA area got numerous film companies. So if you were an actor or a technician and you were not on one movie in Hollywood, you could go across the street and get a job with another moving picture company. Whereas Santa Barbara, it was kind of the only game in town. Mm-hmm. They also, about 1915, started switching to longer movies. So they were making fewer, longer movies. So again, if you were not on a particular movie, you had no work for a couple of months. The other thing going on was sort of the mechanics of how films got to theaters. Initially, there were three main parts. There was the studio, there was the distributor sending the movies out to the theaters, and then the theaters themselves. Eventually, over time, it became apparent that it was economically advantageous to have all three of them, these entities, become one and the same. So Fox is one that we know of. And in fact, in Santa Barbara, there's a theater there, which now is now called the Arlington Theater, but it was originally built as a Fox Theater. And there's still old pictures around that have the big words Fox at the top of the theater. So Flying A kind of lost out on that as well. It's a little bit similar to the VHS versus Betamax. And, you know, when they were first coming out, people really didn't know which way it was going to go.
Betsy, you've written an array of different books. And you did a whole series about the early decades in Santa Barbara, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the book series and what the series name is called.
Okay, the series is called Way Back When, and it's Way Back When, Santa Barbara in 1914, Way Back When, Santa Barbara in 1915, all the way up through 1919. So I did the second half of the teens.
So you have spent a lot of time in your recent life transporting yourself back in time.
Yes.
Intensely. Mm-hmm. Because of that, do you ever feel like you lived back in that time, like you know these people that you write about?
Well, I tell you, I feel a stronger connection to my grandmother than I ever did. She was born in 1901, so she would have been, you know, a teenager going through World War I and then the Spanish flu. She never talked to me about either of those things, and I'm wondering in the future, will we talk to our grandkids about the COVID crisis?
Right.
One of the things that I did is I mentioned that I had a business researching and writing about older homes in the Chicago area, and I wrote a book called Discovering the History of Your House and Your Neighborhood. Recently, I was interviewed by Atlas Obscura, which is a travel website, but they, now that people are not traveling, they were looking for things that people could do from home. And one of the things that you can do, thanks to the internet in large part, is delve into the history of your home. You're at home, and maybe you start looking around and thinking, well, why did they build it that way, and how come that room is over there, et cetera, et cetera?
Give us some examples of starting points. You have an old home, and you're curious. Where do you go? What do you do?
Well, one easy thing that you can do is to go and dig out your closing papers. You probably have a 2-inch-high stack of papers that you filed away and you haven't looked at since you moved in. But you can go through the papers and see if there are any indications about former owners of the house. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll find something called an abstract of title, which will list all of the former owners of the house, maybe for the last 50 years. And in large part, the history of your house is the history of the people who lived there. And if you are looking for old pictures of your house, that's one of the best sources of information. The other thing that you can do online is to look at what are called old city directories, which are basically old phone books.
And they used to say what the person did, their employment, too.
They were wonderful. A lot of them had what we would call a reverse index in the back. In addition to having the alphabetical index in the front, in the back of it, they would have street by street, house number by house number, who was living there. And then you can find the name for your address, flip to the front, and yes, you'll find the husband's name, the wife's names, his occupation, whether they owned or rented, sometimes the names of adult children. Then, thanks to the internet, you can go on some of the genealogy websites, and some of them have deals where you can, you know, join up for free for a month or something like that. Or I actually have a chapter in my book called Take a Genealogist to Lunch. If you know someone who's a genealogist, ask them where you might find information. I've had some cool stuff happen. I was researching a house in the Chicago area, and it was built about 1915. It was a 2.5-story house in Chicago. And I managed to find the grandson of the people who built it. First, I wrote to him. I recommend not cold calling, because you cold call someone about your house, and they think, oh, my God, you know, something wasn't done properly, and someone got hurt, and I'm being sued.
Right.
I recommend writing to them, telling you're researching the house, it's a really cool house, etc., and then see if you can call them, talk to them, see if they have old pictures. So this grandson that I found was really nice, and he sent me a picture of his grandparents, the ones who had built the house. And then he said to me, do the current owners know that the house has been raised? And I said, you mean knocked down, R-A-Z-E-D? And he said, no, raised up. The house was originally built to be a 1.5-story house, and the owners wanted more room, so they had the house picked up and they built a new first floor. This was fairly common in the Chicago area. So no, the current owners had no idea that the first floor was not as old as the second and third floors.
Interesting. Okay, let's zoom forward in time to the 1920s in Santa Barbara, and there was a horrific earthquake that destroyed a lot of buildings and changed the architectural future of Santa Barbara. A lot of people don't know that there was this awful earthquake here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Santa Barbara looks the way it does today thanks to the earthquake and thanks to a group of people who were pushing for a cohesive style before the earthquake. There was a woman named Pearl Chase, a man named Bernard Hoffman, and they had the Plans and Planting Commission, and they were drawing up plans and, you know, trying to get people interested in their plans.
Because before, it was a real hodgepodge.
Yeah, there were adobes, but along State Street kind of, as Neil Graffy, one of the Santa Barbara historians, said, State Street looked more like Toledo, Ohio than Toledo, Spain. And a lot of those buildings on State Street are from the 1800s. They were wooden, and they just slumped down onto the sidewalk. Fortunately, the big quake was about 6:45 in the morning, so only about a dozen people were killed. But while the city was still in ruins, the Plans and Planting Commission said, hey, we've got these plans, let's do it.
So following the earthquake, there's been a literal mandate to have this cohesive Spanish mission revival style of architecture throughout the core of Santa Barbara, true?
Yes, throughout the core. And if you're on the hillside where you can be seen from the harbor, you have different rules than if you're in a flat area where you can't be seen from a distance. It makes Santa Barbara look like what it does today, and that's why people come to Santa Barbara.
A couple days ago, you posted on Facebook a picture of a lighthouse that crashed down, and it was such a mess, I couldn't even make sense of the photo.
I know, yes. That was from the 1925 earthquake. We had a lighthouse on the Mesa area, which was an elevated area. It had been built in 1856.
Wow.
And so it had been there quite a while. Fortunately, no one was injured at the time, but because of the earthquake, the whole tower of the lighthouse just fell right on down. Now, there is a twin of this lighthouse that was built a little earlier in the San Diego area at Point Loma. So there is a lighthouse there that is exactly the same as ours.
So they never rebuilt that lighthouse?
No, our lighthouse was never rebuilt. They just sort of built a beacon tower, which just doesn't have the appeal of a lighthouse. Sorry.
Yeah. Are you still stuck in the teens and the 20s in Santa Barbara?
Well, yes, I am. And it's kind of good news, bad news about the whole virus situation. I had pretty much finished a book on silent movies filmed in Montecito, and then I was starting to research a book about silent movies filmed out on the Channel Islands. I initially thought there were only about 50, and earlier this spring I started realizing there were a whole lot more than 250, but that was kind of about the same time the COVID lockdown was coming on, so I was going to be home anyway. So I probably would not have taken on a task this big under normal circumstances, but I'm stuck at home, and I'm happy in the research rabbit hole, and thank God the internet is still working, so there's a lot that I can do online.
Have you ever fantasized about a Betsy Green film festival of films that were filmed in Santa Barbara?
Well, one of the...
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would. One of the problems is a lot of these early movies don't exist anymore. Mm. They were on this flammable substance called cellulose nitrate that sometimes burst into flames just with the friction going through the projector. In fact, in some theaters, the area where the projector and the projectionists were sort of steel-lined because there were fires. And then also when the talkies came in, it was a huge change for both the theaters and the studios. No longer could you have a huge gymnasium-type building divided into little rooms where there was four different movies being filmed at the same time. For the silence, it didn't matter. But with the talkies, it had to be quiet. So it was a big change in the movie industry. So they wanted people to go see the talkies, because they were spending an awful lot of money changing the studios and changing the theaters as well. So some of them were just left to rot. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, there's a treasure trove. A couple of years ago, somebody found a whole bunch of old movies up in Dawson, Alaska.
Wow.
Which was the end of the line. The movies were sent up there. They mm-hmm. weren't expected back. They didn't know what to do with them. So they ended up throwing them in an old swimming pool and just filling them in with dirt. And it wasn't until recently they started digging it up for some other construction and realized, hey, what is this stuff? Maybe it's valuable. They occasionally find things in old film museums in Buenos Aires where they thought, my God, we thought this was gone for years and years. Mm-hmm. And just recently there was something posted on Facebook where they think now that there are some movies that they thought were lost in Cuba, that they had been sent to Cuba. They just hung on to them. Maybe they're still watching them down there. And a film historian is planning to go to Cuba to see what it is that they have there. So it's very exciting.
One more cool Betsy Green Santa Barbara subject.
Well, one of the things that I'm looking for in the old movie magazines is little snippets of information. And I don't find it for every movie, but for one movie, people were out filming somewhere and realized that they had been running around in poison oak. So everybody broke out in spots. So they had to stop the filming for about a week until the spots went away and people stopped scratching. The other thing that I really enjoy are the old movie magazines and how they exaggerate stuff. I call it movie magazine malarkey. There was a movie being filmed on Santa Catalina Island in the 20s with Gloria Swanson and Rudolph Valentino. And so she was out there in a rowboat and she was supposed to fall in the water at some point. So she went into the water, according to the movie magazine, and then and only then did they realize she didn't know how to swim. So here's Gloria Swanson flailing around, going down for the third time, and who jumps in to save her? Rudolph Valentino.
I love it.
That is one movie that is still around. It's mm-hmm. called Beyond the Rocks, and you can find it on the internet.
A moment about Betsy Green and your journey. I understand that you spent time living in Asia. I remember a post about you being stationed in Hong Kong.
Yes.
What were you doing there?
Well, I always wanted to travel, and I went to Rutgers from New Jersey, and I majored in Far Eastern Studies. And when I graduated, I moved to Taiwan, and I lived there for a couple of years, studying Chinese, teaching English. And then I moved to Hong Kong, and that's really when I got started in publishing.
So you were with Reader's Digest for
mm-hmm.
a while? Was that there, too?
Yeah, Reader's Digest has a dozen or so editions around the world. So I worked for the English language Asian edition. Our main audience was the Philippines, but people all over Asia who were studying English often, because Reader's Digest English is fairly simple in structure, and so people who are studying English would subscribe to Reader's Digest. Mm-hmm. And from there, I ended up in Chicago, where I worked as an editor at World Book Encyclopedia.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next. Must have been fascinating, some new thing you learned every day.
Oh, yeah, and whatever articles you worked on, you remembered them forever because mm-hmm. you were working on them for a while. I remember one time I worked on the article for Schenectady, New York. And at one point, a couple of years ago, I met someone and we got talking and he said, yeah, I'm from Schenectady. And I said, oh, Schenectady, the city that lights and halls the world. And he almost fell over because I knew that, because General Electric used to be in Schenectady, and that was electricity, and they built locomotive engines there. They don't anymore. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that was Schenectady's claim to fame for a long time.
So what was really cool about your world then, you were like perpetual student.
Well, yes, and World Book was fun because I was with like 30 other editors, and we're all, of course, word nerds, and I used to run limerick contests, so that was fun too.
And then, just by accident, because of something you sent me, you have a comedic background too?
Oh, yeah. Well, I sort of dabbled in the theater, nothing really professional. But when I lived in Chicago, improv is really big in Chicago. So I studied at Second City and a similar place called Comedy Sports. And I started an improv group in the Chicago suburbs.
Second City is legendary in the history of 20th century comedy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, there were some big stars came out of there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It was a cool place to be.
Wasn't John Candy there?
Yeah, and John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and a whole bunch of people.
And there you were.
Yeah, and actually for our graduation we were on the stage, and that was the only time I shared the same stage. But I think improv is great because it frees up your creativity and your comedic impulse. So I try to include humor in all of what I write, and you probably figured that out by now.
You have to have quick brain function for that one.
Yes, okay. It's the sort of yes and sort of key to improv. Somebody says, this is a great day to be on the slopes here, and you don't say, oh, no, we're in New York City. You just say, yes, and look, that guy just broke his leg over there. You just, yes and. This is a great time to be a historian, or a great time just to be interested in history. If it's your own history of your house or your town or just sort of random stuff, the internet is working, and if your curiosity is working too, it's a great combination.
And then up until recently, you did ongoing talks at local organizations, Rotary or whatever, yeah?
Yes.
But that's kind of on hold, isn't it?
Well, I've started doing... Zoom presentations for the Santa Barbara Historical Museum, and I think I will start doing that for other organizations. I think Zoom is the way to go, at least for the next year or two.
If somebody wanted to learn more about Betsy Green and your books, do you have a website?
Sure, I have a website. It's BetsyJGreen.com, and I have a YouTube page as well, Betsy J. Green. So fortunately, I'm the only Betsy J. Green out there who's funny. So.
There you go. I love it. All right, Betsy Green, thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been fun.
This is great. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Ynez Valley. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
I'm Kenneth Hamilton,
Arizona. Okay, boys.
It's after midnight here in London. People are dancing on the rooftop and fireworks are exploding in all directions.
This is the happiest day of my life.
75 years ago, World War II ended. It was the deadliest military conflict in history, resulting in 85 million casualties. We mark the anniversary of the end of that war by celebrating the heroism of our greatest generation, those who served and those who supported their efforts at home. On September 2nd, we will commemorate the signing of the Articles of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri Memorial at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, a celebration of the peace that followed. Salute their service, honor their hope. Join us virtually for the events on September 2nd, 2020. For further information, go to 75thww2commemoration.org.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.